WTZOHR Hood River, a 91.9 FM. The time is 10:30, and coming up next is Film at 11.
Yes, indeed, it is Film at 11. It's a 10:30 a.m. on Friday the 13th. Ooh. Yeah. This is DK Home, and I'm here with Fortunato of the Monday Sampler.
Some people find Friday the 13th lucky.
I think we are going to do so, because I felt lucky receiving a DVD from Criterion of The Story of Temple Drake.
Always fun to get a DVD from Criterion.
It certainly is. It's particularly great because Temple Drake, I never really heard of the movie or knew much about it. I was vaguely aware that it was one of the so-called pre-code movies from 29 to about 34, but I didn't know anything about it, hadn't seen it, and it turns out that this is a particularly good DVD from Criterion, because not only is it a restored version of a film that is out of copyright, and so you can see it on YouTube in a really bad format, apparently.
Yes, I did.
Okay. But it has three extras on it that are really helpful.
Great pieces of film history from what's really an important time in Hollywood history.
Yes.
I've read some books on it. I've seen mentions of the movie.
Right.
It stars Miriam Hopkins. This is right when she was doing Design for Living, and I think it's the same cinematographer who was with her on Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Carl Struess. Yes.
Yes. And the director of this movie is somebody who we also didn't know about.
No, Stephen Roberts, spelled Stephen. He died not too long after completing this movie. So his sound era films comprise about 6 or 8 movies. But before that, he made 100 movies throughout the 20s and the silent era.
And he certainly uses this cinematographer to great effect in this movie. And then one of the extras on this DVD is a look at what was called the storyboards for this film. And they look like these German woodcuts.
Yes, they do.
And like this could actually almost be more of a horror movie than a weepy or a drama movie.
It has several aromas to it. To my mind, it could also be perhaps the very first film noir.
Yeah.
Particularly the way that Carl Struess shoots a certain portion of the movie. But let me tell you what the plot is for those good people out there who don't really know what it's about. It was released in 1934, and it is adapted from, of all things, William Faulkner's novel Sanctuary. Now, Sanctuary is one of his most controversial novels because it was his first bestseller, and he wrote it rather cynically, apparently. And doesn't mean that it's bad, but it does mean that he was trying to push certain buttons in order to formalize a bestseller for himself. Naturally, Paramount wanted to adapt it into a movie, but it's really racy material, and a lot of censorship was involved. In fact, the production board sent a memo to Paramount saying, in part, that this is probably the sickest, dirtiest novel ever published in America, or words to that effect. It was saying it's so depraved and debauched.
In the pre-James Caan
era. Yeah. As terms of plot, it's a little bit like No Flowers for Miss Blandish, if you remember that particular novel, 40, made into a movie several times, including The Grissom Gang by Robert Aldrich. But the important thing here is that Temple Drake, of the title, is the granddaughter of a local judge in presumably Mississippi. But she's a bit of a hellion. And what you would call something in the PM, what you can't call her in the AM, but she's a bit of a tease. And she gets her comeuppance when she falls into the clutches of a gangster played by Jack LaRue, who basically turns her out into a prostitute. And so she's a true fallen woman. You know, she gets the worst of what somebody who is blamed for being a tease could possibly suffer. So one thing leads to another, and it becomes a courtroom drama at the end, before it was a tearjerker, a horror movie in its way, a film noir, and a gangster story. So like many great films, it bridges numerous genres. You know, a lot of the biggest, best popular films, like Back to the Future, traverse numerous genres at once: comedy, science fiction, adventure, and so forth. So this does it too. So Robert Stephen Roberts, about whom I don't know very much yet, is really trying to do something serious with this novel, to really explore female psychology. And Mary Hopkins, in one of the three short video essays on the disc, is described as really wanting to do a complex character. And in fact, she just wasn't much a fan of Hollywood and ended up just returning to the stage. But
like a lot of other great actresses I've come across, there was a woman named Olive Burden. She just they didn't pay her enough, so she quit. Louise Brooks, she couldn't stand being in Hollywood because it was so provincial and small town. There was no culture, no theater or anything going on. And once her contract was kind of, she was done with the picture, she left for New York. She didn't want to come back.
No. And I don't think we've ever heard her voice in a movie. Did she ever do some sound films? Oh, she must have. I just don't remember.
There's a French movie that she had done where she rises to fame and does a lot of bad things along the way. It ends with her movie being shown on the screen, and she's just been shot.
That's right. I have seen that. Yeah, that's a fantastic movie and a fantastic scene. And anybody who really wants to get the full measure of Louise Brooks, the Pandora's Box, she is incredible in that film.
And if you really want to torture yourself, you can go see Overland Stage Raiders with John Wayne, and that was her last picture.
Mm-hmm, understandably. So. Yeah.
But she did some great interviews, and she's great to see in these interviews when she's older. She's just so articulate and opinionated. She's just a delight.
Yeah, she wrote a book called Lulu in Hollywood, which is a gimlet-eyed view of the Tinseltown.
Marion Hopkins would return somewhere. She was later in an episode of Route 66.
That's right.
The TV show.
She was offered numerous roles that went to other people that she turned down, such as Jezebel. Even the main part in Gone with the Wind. But she didn't want to do any of those things because she just preferred the stage.
And she preferred a nice challenge to a role.
Yes, yeah.
And she really does that in this movie. There's a wide range of emotions and situations that she goes through.
And they're difficult scenes to convey. And one of the incredible things, there's so much innovation in this movie. For example, there's one scene where Jack LaRue is threatening her, where the two actors, you know, about 90 years before Apocalypse Now, look right into the camera as the camera slowly tracks in on them one after the other to show the ominous nature of this moment. The movie begins with a zoom shot.
Yeah,
I think it was manufactured out of the camera, but the very first shot is of the county courthouse, and the camera zooms in on the name of the county or on courthouse. So lots of innovations, lots of clever use of sound, just a really gripping story with interesting characters in it. So this is a fantastic thing. Now, talk a little bit about what is pre-code.
Just before I do that, I wanted to mention one thing. I was sort of noticing that Miriam Hopkins at this time looks a little bit like Brie Larson. But that's another thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so pre-code is this time, there was this production code that was imposed into Hollywood almost sort of for their own protection. Censorship boards were propping up in different states around the country due to certain scandals that had become nationwide known from Hollywood, the death of William Desmond Taylor, the director.
Fatty Arbuckle.
Fatty Arbuckle's trial and a bunch of other things that were going on. And so the respectable people, the busies, they wanted to censor movies. And so they would take the movie and chop it up. And then, you know, that would be a cost to the studios. So they initially tried to have a board that would, like, intercede and say, don't worry, we're going to edit these things for you. Eventually, they're taken over by this guy named Joseph Breen, a kind of political operative who...
And a devout Catholic. And
he gets the Catholic Church to start making up lists of bad movies. And this really hits the exhibition side of the movie industry.
Yeah.
So that they go along with this guy. And so he starts, he's right there at the script phase, and he's intervening on what can be done and what can't be done. And one thing that's pointed out in this documentary, that the aberrant time, you know, sometimes it was looked back like when we first saw these in college, like, wow, this was a really interesting little time where there was this really nice expression of real emotions and real dramas in the movies. We didn't see that. And what a unique little period that is. And so we call it pre-code. But in actuality, the aberrant time is from after the code.
Yes.
From 1934 to 1968 when the code ended, when all of these things were imposed on movies. You look at a comedy from like the early 60s or late 50s, like Sunday in New York or Where the Boys Are, or all the Beach Blanket movies. And there's just this sort of thing in them that they're being constantly held back. It reminds me of a story I heard once by Johnny Otis, the R&B artist. He was doing a radio show in L.A. when I lived there. And he would talk about, they would do these dances that would be mixed race dances. There would be a rope that would be strung through the middle of the hall, and the black kids on one side and the white kids on the other side. And they'd be dancing. At some point, the rope would drop down, and they'd be dancing. Some old woman would come up and just take the mic right from Otis's mouth. Now we got to get you kids over there. You know, they just were imposing these views on everybody.
Well, that was part of the cause for the code. Now, before I say anything, I should make it clear that there was a production code.
Yeah.
It just wasn't enforced. So pre-code makes it sound as if there was no code, but in fact it existed, but it was... slowly, the films were becoming so much racier and forthright that eventually the story of Temple Drake was the last straw. And that's when the machinery, the institutionalization of a body to really enforce the code finally took over. And one of the, miscegenation was one of the crucial planks of the code.
Yeah.
And this movie is, so race, particularly in the South, which was very dear to the studios, race there was obviously a very touchy subject, so they had to back off from it. So, for example, in Temple Drake, one will notice that at the beginning, when the plot is being set up, one of the main characters is defending somebody in a court, but you don't even see the client because he was African American. And but also there was that part, but there's also the disempowering women.
Yeah.
So from in the so-called pre-code movies, they're social climbers and free-spirited people, and then after the code, they are
in their place,
housewives. Yeah. Homemakers, with some exceptions, like Katharine Hepburn in some of her movies where she can play an attorney.
Well, you notice in the Thin Man movies, the first one, which comes right about at the start, our end of the pre-code era, is they're married, but they're out partying and having a great time all the time. In the second film, which is also very good, after the Thin Man, she's pregnant.
Yes.
And they become domesticated.
Exactly.
And there's all these things of Nicky having to be domesticated and be a father. And so all the fun stuff seemed to be like moved out of the Thin Man series.
Well, so that's...
And then the Andy Hardy series and all these
Yes, MGM was the capital of this bucolic vision of America. But
they made money.
Yes.
They made the Shirley Temple became the top box office grosser. And at Universal, they were able to get away from those horrible horror movies and focus on Deanna Durbin singing in front of an orchestra.
Yeah.
And all those other things. And so they made money. And it was in the Depression and movies that really focused at getting together and being good seemed to...
Exactly.
Really
What's interesting, though, there are several books about the pre-code era. One of them is called Sin in Soft Focus, and that's a good one. It's mostly a picture book, if I remember right. But a really good one is Thomas Doherty's Pre-Code Hollywood. And in the introduction, he makes the interesting point that you know, we laugh at the production code now, but if you look at the document carefully, it actually is a work of great moral fortitude that is trying to clean up and give guidance to young people and to adults how to educate young people and emphasize the brighter side of life.
It was eventually replaced by the different letters that we have now.
That's right.
Which kind of function is like the code now sort of like stands outside the theater and says, you might not want to go in there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas back during the code, they held the door open and said, oh, it's safe to go in.
Yes, and the filmmakers weren't even allowed to shoot some of these. The scripts were edited by Breen and his staff before they even went into production. And so people like Billy Wilder and Alfred Hitchcock would have to play various tricks. And sometimes they would put things in that were dirtier than the thing that they wanted to keep in, so that, we'll remove this scene. You're right, it is a little licentious. And it's so strong that the censors don't notice that there's something else that's a little...
Yeah, they worked things out.
Yes.
There are a lot of interesting movies that came out during the code period. And it's interesting, as Martin Scorsese would say, the director had to become a smuggler.
Yeah.
And had to work things
that's
in.
That's right. And some people, for example, one of the interview subjects in these extras on the disc...
Praise. Once again, we're talking. It's the strange life.
The story of Temple Drake.
The story of Temple Drake.
And in one of the DVD extras, the head of the Herrick Museum in Los Angeles makes a statement that you hear a lot, which is that the fact of censorship compels filmmakers to be more creative, and I see the point of that, but I. You don't get much more creative than the story of Temple Drake, you know, and because now you've got nuance and you've got a woman with, as they say these days, agency, who has to learn about herself and learn something that changes her position in relation to her family and to her society. And you don't come to that in a lot of these movies from the Andy Hardy school of filmmaking.
No. So this is the story of Temple Drake, and it's just out on DVD. Is there a Blu-ray version?
Both, yes.
Both. From Criterion, once again, with great extras that you can view at your pleasure.
Yes, and it's just the pre-code movie. It's just, like you could say, there's no really bad film noir, which is something I believe. There's really no bad pre-code film. Either they're really funny, or they're really racy, or they're very empowering, or they just tell it straight about aspects of society that people don't want to face, such as crime and poverty, etc. So it's definitely worth...
Another thing they brought out was this print is complete, because the whole movie was condemned.
Yes.
There was like... And so after the code came in, there were movies that were re-shown in the late 30s, a few of them, but they would like take the questionable scenes out of them. And then movies like Temple Drake, they just wouldn't show them.
Yeah, it was very hard to see for many, many decades. And I think that's part of one of the reasons why in his book, Thomas Doherty doesn't quite give the movie the credit it deserves.
Yeah.
You know, I read it after I saw the extras and I realized, oh, I don't, you know, he's a great thinker and a great writer, very entertaining academic book composer, but I think he just didn't quite get how innovative this one was.
It's very innovative.
It is innovative.
And you can catch that, but also it's like there are a lot of movies that are just gone, like Convention City is one with Joan Blondell and a few others that they just don't exist anymore, or then the ones that they just would take a scene out of it and they'd destroy the negative.
Yeah,
so
that's
we could
too
never
bad.
See
we'll
it.
Never see that thing. But,
some of them.
You know, some of these movies like Night Nurse, Babyface, Dishonored, and so forth, they're really great movies. A lot of them come from Warner Brothers, but so Paramount doing this one is not unusual, but they weren't the primary source of these. But anyway, that is the story of Temple Drake, and we just love that movie. And
we do.
Thank you, Criterion, for making it accessible in a beautiful print. I just thought of something else I like about it. There's a scene, the photography in it, once they leave the city and go out to this speakeasy house.
Roadhouse.
A roadhouse way out of in the country. There's a scene where Jack LaRue is going to come in and attack Miriam Hopkins. So he's backlit. He opens the door. He's silhouetted. And he closes the door. And he has a cigarette light in his mouth. And as the door closes, the screen goes jet black, except for the hot tip of his cigarette. And it is stunning. Stunning how that looks.
Just the type of photography existing at that time to be able to pull off that effect. Mm-hmm. This is the same cinematographer who did the effects in Jekyll and Hyde, where mm-hmm. they use different filters to
yes.
have the transformation.
Yeah,
scene.
It's a big secret, but that's eventually came out that's yeah. That's how I think. This is the Ruben Mamoulian version of
Hyde.
Well, again, this is DK Holm. I'm here with Fortunato of the Monday Sampler. It's Friday the 13th, and this is Film 11. And now we're going to try. Let me just make a
quick... Well, this would make a great Christmas present, wouldn't it?
It sure would. It actually would. It's such a good movie. And it sparks some interesting conversation. So it's the 13th, and so the movies coming out today are Black Christmas, Richard Jewell, Seberg, and several others. And all these movies and revivals you can find listed on the Film 11 episode page on the archive on the KBOO.FM website. So it's a service that we as volunteers provide. You know, we here at Film 11 make up the list and post it on the day of the show. So you can it has links and you can find out what the movies are and look around and saves you a little time when you're trying to figure out what movie you want to see at some place like the Laurelhurst or the Hollywood or the Kiggins and so many of these other great revival houses, Cinema 21, et al. But the movie that came out today is that I want to talk about for a couple of sentences before we move on is Jumanji, the second Jumanji movie, which is technically called The Next Level. Jumanji, The Next Level. I really enjoyed the first one. It's very fun.
It was.
This one is just as good, and it has maybe some higher stakes to it, but they also change it up a little bit. So you will recall, Forty, that when they enter the game, something that's never really kind of truly
you
explained.
You have the main characters, and then we go into like a dream state. Game state, where they transform into other people.
Into avatars that are in the game. But this time around, different people. Or a different person is inside Jack Black and a different person is inside
Dwayne Johnson.
So that can lead to some confusion if you remember mostly what they were in the other. But it's very funny, and it's very funny for the old-timer, the people who'd been in the game before, how impatient they get with the Johnson and the Black characters who are different, who are older people. In the real world, how slow they are at getting yes, you are an avatar, So it's really entertaining, and it ends on a note of a very obvious number three is going to come up. So
okay,
I won't spoil that, of course. But
man, Dwayne Johnson is a pretty darn good actor.
Yeah, he has because of who he's become. He has to have a kind of a Bronx, New York accent. Which he does reasonably well.
I thought he was good way back in that movie based on that Elmore Leonard novel, Be Cool.
Yeah, so Dwayne Johnson's really great in that and so many other movies. But, here at Film 11, we try to get into the Christmas spirit as much as we can.
Is it that time again?
It is, surprisingly. And being Friday the 13th, we've got a slightly different take on the Christmas movie.
Oh yeah, there's different sort of subgenres of the Christmas movie. We've always liked the action film, like the Die Hard version.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Bang Bang. Well, speaking of that, I mean, I think Iron Man 3 could be a Christmas movie. We could talk about that at another time.
Of course.
But the horror movie crossover with the Christmas movie is kind of pretty good.
And there's so many exemplary examples of that, starting with Night of the Hunter.
Yes, from the early 50s.
58, I believe.
And that stars Robert Mitchum in one of his roles. And it's got a final role with the great Lillian Gish.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about two children who are on the run from this murderer who's just murdered their mother, who was played by Shelley Winters. And they're on the run. He comes off like he's this preacher, and he's so nice. And, oh, hi, children. But no, he wants to kill them. And so they run off, and they finally are taken in by this older woman.
And by contrast, she...
Yeah, she's like, what are you kids doing? You get to take a bath. What are you doing? Which sort of is showing who people really care. But also, it's got a nice... it's not so much a nailing down Christmas so much, but Christmas is there. The whole film kind of shows the chaotic adult world and how you make your own safety, your own safe place.
Yeah, and not everybody likes a movie where children are imperiled, but nevertheless... if you do, it's beautifully photographed. It's a gothic southern noir, not unlike the first movie we were talking about.
Yeah.
And it's a great Christmas movie. It's a great movie,
anyway,
whatever.
Yeah, the Night of the Hunter.
Yeah, but what else is on your to-do
sometimes
list?
There's like fantasy films that would come out on television around this time, like Michael Powell's The Thief of Baghdad. Mm-hmm. Which is a great, great movie. And then there would be this Paramount version of Lewis Carroll, where they would, it's like the combination of Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass. So you'd have the garden and then the chess game and stuff. And Paramount did this big all-star version of it in the early 30s. It's so weird looking because the makeup is so awful. You can't tell who's who. I mean, they made to look like the famous illustrations, which kind of works against in a way. And so that would be a movie that would come out around Christmas time. We would see it on television. Like, what is this movie? You tune it in halfway. You didn't know what's going on. And another one is one by Stan Laurel, which was originally called Babes in Toyland. Disney did a remake of it around early 60s with Annette Funicello. And so he takes the title, Babes in Toyland. So the film by Laurel and Hardy had to be changed to The March of the Wooden Soldiers. Mm-hmm. And this takes place in your classic Mother Goose storybook town or lane or whatever.
This isn't a department store.
Not a department. It would be copied in department stores,
okay.
It seems like. And so you had the old woman who lives in the shoe, and you've got Little Bo Peep, and you've got all these other characters, and Stan and Ollie are in there too. And then there's this evil character called Barnaby who is trying to foreclose on the woman in the shoe. he's played by an actor named...
Henry Brandon.
Henry Brandon, who does a lot of movies. He was he's one of these faces you'd see all the time. In fact, he's in the John Ford movie, The Searchers. He plays Scar,
yes,
the Indian chief.
20 years after being in March of the Wooden Soldiers.
Which is probably his first movie role, I think.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah, and he played villains on TV. I think he's even in the first version of Assault on Precinct 13.
That's right. He's the first cop to get shot at the start.
Yeah. And so, but back in this movie, he's got these boogeymen that he controls, and it's really scary at a certain point. And Stan had mistakenly, they were supposed to bring out something like, 130-inch like 106-inch toy soldiers, but no, he ended up taking out 106-foot toy soldiers or something like that. And so now they've got the toy soldiers who can, when the monsters attack, the toy soldiers. So that's what leads up to. So it's a kind of fantasy fairyland sort of,
and it's
Christmassy.
Easily
thing.
Available on,
yes, it is.
DVD or maybe
or
we
YouTube.
Hope streaming.
I think, I think YouTube might have it because it's one of those that was in public domain.
Yes. Well, I'll briefly mention mine, which is scary in a certain way. It's called Eyes Wide Shut, Stanley Kubrick's last movie, and a lot of people don't like it. But the more I think about it and watch it, the more I grow to really appreciate how tense it conveys our world of human sexuality and how nervous making and uncertain it is, and at this this man's journey through the night. So Sight and Sound just dedicated a whole issue to it last month. But so that's a little bit more grown up than other films.
So Eyes Wide Shut,
Eyes Wide
March
Shut.
Of the Wooden Soldiers, The Story of Temple Drake.
That's right. And This has been DK Home with Fortunato.
Hey.
And this is Film 11. I hope you get to hear us next week.
Take a little time out to you. Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for contributing to KBOO's membership drive. It was a success, and we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click. Summation needs a TTTT.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday at 4:30 p.m.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K20HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. The time is 11 o'clock, and coming up next is the Digital Divide.